we finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was much a fact as we were. We found a great reality deep down within us. And the last analysis is it's only there that he may be found. It was so with us. Now, my book is telling me that God dwells within me. And today we believe that every man, woman, and child on the face of this earth has the basic fundamental knowledge of God deep down within themselves. Now, some people may call that innate intelligence. Some people may call that common sense. Some people may call that the conscience, and others may call it the soul, and I really don't think it makes any difference what we call it. But each one of us, deep down within inside of ourselves, have some form of basic knowledge where we've always known the differences between right and wrong. We've always known what we should do and what we shouldn't do. And in the past, many of us at many times have been in contact with that knowledge and really didn't realize what it was. I believe God has always dwelled within me. You know, I know that I've had contact with him in the past before. Because sometimes I'd be getting ready to do something, and some little inner voice from somewhere inside myself would say, "Charlie, I don't think you ought to be doing this." And I'd go right ahead and do it. And then that little voice would say, "See, I told you not to do it." And I've always had that there. And I think each one of us has got that there. I think that's the difference between us and the rest of the animals on the face of this earth, is this form of intelligence, this God-like thing, dwells within each of us. And that power is there, and it's always been there. And if we could just simply learn how to tap into that power, I believe we all have the knowledge already that we need in order to be able to live and be peaceful and happy and free, but we never could live up to that before because our chase for money, power, prestige, and sex always obscured that, and we never would listen to that information. Now, if that's true, and I believe it is, then God dwells in you as well as he dwells within me, and then each of us could have our own personal God. You know, this is the great thing this book has given to me. I'm no longer concerned with whether he's the God of the Baptist Church, the Hebrew religion, the Catholic religion, or whatever. If God dwells within me, then he is my own personal God. I have a completely new understanding of God. No longer do I think he's hellfire and brimstone. I think he's there, and I think the power is there, and I think he's there in each of us. And if we could learn to tap into that power, then we're going to find the power to overcome our disease of alcoholism. This is the great thing that this chapter has given to me. God is thy understanding and a new understanding of God. Joe?
As Charlie said, if that God is within us, then our job is to uncover and discover and get rid of the things that block us from that. And it's already there. We don't have to hunt for it. So we see that we're getting, as we move into how it works, into the 10 steps in the recovery, these steps will be the steps we take, actually, these are actions we take to remove the things that block us from God. Now, it's not of anything new. It's not about getting anything so much as it is getting rid of things. I mean, we don't have to get anything. In fact, we got too much already. We got to get rid of some things. Okay, and this brings us to the third and final part, how it works. Okay. Charlie's got some pictures he wants to show.
Get somebody to do the lights. Hope it'll work today.
We got it. Okay, here on the screen we're going to be talking about, we talked about the problem, and now this is the solution. The solution is power. On the left-hand side of the screen we'll see the group, the AA fellowship. We see the older members in the group around the outside and the new member being supported by the old member. You know, it's totally impossible for a new person not to look at the members of this group and not get some hope and some strength. And he's supported by the old members in the group. And also the old members that get in the group, They get strength from helping a new member. And it's a therapeutic process there. And it's strength in that group. Now, while the new person's in that group, he can't help but become willing and to believe these people. And if he believes them, and he makes a decision, he goes over and he picks up a simple kit of spiritual tools laid at his feet. And if he believes them and does what they tell what they said they did, then he applies these steps to his life. And as a result of these steps, he has a revolutionary change in his whole attitude and outlook toward life. A personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism as the results of these steps. And this is the real part of the solution to the problem of alcoholism. Now, once he has a personality change as a result of these steps, having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps, then he has faith. He knows it works too. Now, once he knows it works and gets the results, then he can come over and be a part of the circle and support the next new person. So it's a circle where they believe, they make a decision, they act, they get faith, and then they come back and then they can give this to the next person. This is the way the first 100 people have grown to the fellowship today. This is the solution to alcoholism. Now, once we have those two things, we know we're at a turning point. We know the problem. The problem is lack of power. And lack of power because of the physical allergy and the mental obsession. That's the problem. And obvious, if a lack of power is our dilemma, then our solution is power. And when we just said that that power is in the fellowship and the spiritual experience. And if we have those two steps, then those two things, we have two facts in our lives. We know that there's a power, and we know that we're powerless, and that we know that there's a power. So we know those two things. And if we have those two facts, then we are at a turning point. We are ready to make a decision. And the word decision comes from the word dissect, which means choose a course of action. And if you're an alcoholic with honesty, you got two choices. One is continue as you are, lack of power, or life on a spiritual basis, the power. This is the turning point, and we are now at that decision. Is that it?
I think what's so important here is if we hadn't had the information we've been looking at up to this point, we wouldn't be able to make this decision.
That's right.
See, based on our old ideas about God, hell, fire, and brimstone, I couldn't make that decision. Based upon the idea I didn't think God would do anything for me, I couldn't make that decision because I didn't believe. But now after I've read the chapter to the agnostics, my belief is beginning to change. So now I can decide clearly between two things. If I choose to continue to disbelieve, then I'm probably going to continue to drink as I always have. And that disbelief is going to lead me to insanity or death. My book's already told me that. But if I choose to believe, which I now can do because of chapter 4, then that belief is going to lead me to accept spiritual help or a life of sanity and sobriety. But I could never have made the decision that I'm going to have to make in just a little while without these chapters that we've been looking at and studying all the way through the book, and especially chapter 4. Because now that I've got a new idea about God, a new understanding of God, now I can go ahead and make that decision. And I think Bill, at this point of the game, he decided that he had told us enough, and he had taught us all he needed to tell us about our disease of alcoholism, and all that he needed to tell us about this spiritual thing. And now he says it's time for us to make our decision.
That's right.
And go to work on this thing. So it's not by accident that he named the next chapter, chapter 5, How It Works.
That's right.
We've looked at the problem, we've looked at the solution. And now we're getting ready to start looking at the practical program of action necessary to find that solution. Now, you got to remember that the 12 steps had never been written before. And Bill started writing on the book in 1937. Now, here it is, the spring of 1938. And he's ready to write how it works. And Bill did not feel adequate to do this job. He knew that when he wrote this part of the book, that this would determine whether we're going to recover later on or whether we're not. They'd been using the little six ideas that they had received from the Oxford groups, and they were very broad indeed. The Oxford groups were an all-purpose group. Anybody could join, providing they were willing to do certain things. Didn't make any difference whether a problem was with food or alcohol or gambling or sex or whatever it might be. And they could already see that it didn't pay to mix these things together. Oxford groupers and alcoholics were already having problems with each other. Oxford groupers really didn't much like us vomiting on their living room rugs and burning holes in the carpets and all that kind of stuff. So he could see that this probably needed to be a single-purpose group. And being an alcoholic and knowing the mind of the alcoholic, he could see so many loopholes in those six little steps that they had been using for us to slip through, that he knew that they needed to be broadened out some. He did not know how far, had no idea what he should do. And they tell us that one night in bed, and he always loved to write in bed, he was leaning against the headboard, pillow behind his back, pad and pencil in hand, trying to start how it works, and just could not get started. And they said he laid his pad and pencil down and prayed and meditated for 15 or 20 minutes. I have no idea what he said. I'm sure he asked for guidance. And at the end of 15 or 20 minutes, he picked up his pad and pencil and began to write. And Bill always said that it felt as if the pencil had a mind of its own. And as he began to write, he wrote how it works. He wrote the 12-step program. He didn't know how many steps he had written until he went back later and counted them. And he said it seemed as though it looked like there was 12 there, and he associated that with the 12 apostles and thought maybe that would be right. Now, we're going to read how it works, but we're not going to read how it works out of your book. We're going to read it how Bill wrote it that night. Before any of the other members got to see it, before any changes were made in it, before the rest of the fellowship got through tearing it up. And I think if we see what Bill wrote that night, we'll be able to see what he's been trying to do to us and for us all the way through the doctor's opinion in the first four chapters. Let's look at how it works from the original manuscript of Alcoholics Anonymous. Joe's going to read it, and Joe will try through changing the tone of his voice to point out the differences between what it was then and what it is today in the book. If you want to follow through with your book, you'll be able to see several differences, Joe.
Okay. Chapter 5, how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our directions. Those who do not recover are people who cannot completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing the way of life which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave and emotional mental disorders. But many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our story discloses in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided that you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to follow directions. As some of these, you may balk. You may think you can find an easier, softer way. We doubt if you can. Okay. With all earnestness, we at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and honest from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that you are dealing with alcohol, cunning and baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for you. But there is one who has all power, that one is God. You must find him now. Half measures will avail you nothing. You stand at a turning point, throw yourself under his protection and care with complete abandon. Now we think you can take it. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as your program of recovery.
Not a program, as your program of recovery.
Okay. Number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, but our lives have become unmanageable. Number two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Number three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care and direction of God as we understood him. Number four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Number five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Number six, were entirely willing that God remove all these defects of character. Number seven, humbly, on our knees, asked him to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back. That's tough. Number eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make complete amends to them all. Number nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except to do so would injure them or others. Number ten, continue to take a personal inventory when we were wrong, promptly admit it. Number 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our contact with God, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Number 12, having had a spiritual experience as a result of this course of action, we try to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. You may explain, what an order. I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us have been able to mean anything like perfect hearers of these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic.
That's the doctor's opinion. It's part of chapter 2 and part of chapter 3.
The chapter to the agnostic.
That's chapter 4.
Our personal adventures before and after.
Bill's story and those stories in the back of the book.
Have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. Okay. A, that you're alcoholic and cannot manage your life.
That's step one.
B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism.
That's the first half of step two.
See that God can and will.
And that's the rest of step two.
Okay. He said, if you are not convinced of these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point or else throw it away.
Now, I think it's very obvious that Bill intended for the doctor's opinion and the first four chapters to sell us on three pertinent ideas. He has taught us all the way through. Mm-hmm. And those three pertinent ideas are really the ideas contained in steps 1 and 2. Now, if he sold us on those ideas, then the next thing says, we were now at step 3. And used to, I'd read how it works, and I'd say, where in the hell did 1 and 2 go? Because the book tells you how to work 3 through 12. But it never tells you how to work 1 and 2. You see, they are not working steps. They are conclusions of the mind that we draw in our head based upon what we've been taught in the doctor's opinion in the first four chapters. And if we're aware of these three pertinent ideas, then we've already taken steps one and two, and we're ready to go right on with step three. If we're not aware of these three pertinent ideas, he suggests that we reread the book to this point, or else throw it away, one of the two, recognizing you can't take 3 through 12 until you have had 1 and 2. I think it's also obvious that Bill never intended for these to be a set of suggestions. Three times he's mentioned directions and how it works. And when he took it to the other members and they saw it, that's when the crap hit the fan. They said, "What do you mean, giving people directions?" They said, "You know you can't give alcoholics directions. They just won't do a damn thing if you do." And Bill said, "That's the way I want it, just like it has been written." He said, "That information came after prayer and meditation." He said, "I'm not about to change it." And they said, "Bill, don't you remember that you are to write the book, but we are to be the final authority? And we will have to change around and delete whatever we want to." And they, Bill said, "You're not going to change this." And they said, "The hell we're not." And the fight was on. One guy, Jimmy the Atheist, and you ought to see his picture. He's sitting there and he's got an old long stem pipe in his hand. He's the most cold-eyed sucker I ever saw. He looks like an atheist, really ought to look. Jimmy said, "Get all that God stuff out of there. We want no mention of God whatsoever in this book." And then there was a faction that were very religious, and they wanted more God in here. They wanted to talk about the Lord and Jesus Christ, and so the fight was on. And they fought, and they fought, and they fought, and they fought, and they almost destroyed the book project. And finally, Bill recognized that he would have to compromise. And at the suggestion of a non-alcoholic psychiatrist, this guy said, "Why don't you change it from directions to suggestions?" He said, "I believe more people would probably use your book." And he said, "Well, you keep saying you, you, you." He said, "Won't you say we? Don't tell them what they got to do. Tell them what you had to do." And he said, "Well, you keep saying must. He said, "Change that to ought. And he said, "I think more people would use your book." So they changed it, and today we don't know. Now, if they hadn't made those changes, instead of 1.5 million worldwide, we might have 10 million people today in AA. But also, if they hadn't made those changes, instead of 1.5 million worldwide, we might have 10,000 in AA today. I have no idea, and nobody else does. We simply know this is the history behind the book. I think the only reason Bill was willing to compromise was this. He said, "Okay, I'm going to go along with you and make these changes." But he said, "I want to tell you one thing for sure. That from now on, I will be the final authority on the rest of the book."
Yeah.
He said, "I'll not go through this with you anymore. If I'm going to have to fight with you and argue with you, then I'm through with the book project right now." Well, hell, they didn't want to write the book, so they agreed. Now, what he knew, but what they didn't know,
Snake.
Was he was going to put directions right back in the book. 2 pages later, he puts it back, and it runs all the way through the book. So they ruined some of the continuity of the book when they took directions out of how it works, but then it was left in the rest of the book. And always I've been confused about that until I read the original How It Works. I think one of the most interesting stories there, too, is the night Bill wrote this thing. Oh, you know he had to be spiritually enthused. He just could not wait to show it to somebody else. And within a matter of minutes after he had finished, one of the other members came by with his new pigeon to visit Bill. And Bill just couldn't wait to show this to him. And that other member read that and he said, "Bill, what in the hell is this?" He said, "This is a bunch of damn garbage if I ever saw it." Bill Wilson, they say that Bill was depressed in later years. No wonder he was. Because everything he ever tried to do for us, we fought him. And that whole bunch fought him and thought they didn't want this.
Didn't like it.
They had been using six steps. And here comes Bill with 12 steps. Put yourself in that position. When you went to your meeting at your group the last time, when you left there, they had 12 steps. What would you do if you went back tomorrow and they had 24 steps? Bill had to fight them every step of the way. He had to do it with traditions. Nobody wanted the traditions. He had to fight for that. He also had to fight for the service structure and the 12 concepts. No wonder Bill was depressed. Everything he tried to do to help us, we fought him until about 1967. And he finished up the concepts. And then he didn't write any more of this stuff, so there was nothing left to fight about. From 67 to 71, he got okay. You know, I don't blame him for being depressed. I would have been, too. This damn near destroyed the fellowship, the writing of how it works, Joe.
Yeah, Johnny, you know, learning, and then I didn't have a realization for many years. In 1939, very few of the first 100 liked the big book. They did not like what was being done. And it's strange, isn't it? It's strange it was fought all the way. But the Shouter said, you know, he's saying here that, well, you know, I have done enough. You know, I have laid out the first four chapters in the big book and the doctor's opinion. You should have come to these two conclusions. You should have, if you read that, that's why we can't start off with chapter five. Because you don't have the information, take the first two steps. And he said, if you have those first two steps, then you reread them. If you don't have it, read the book and get them or throw it away. But if you do have them, if we are convinced, then we are at step three. Because step three is a decision, and a decision would have to be based on the information in the first four chapters and the doctor's opinion. And the step three is the first step in recovery. Now, back in those days, you remember, AA really began at step three. AA is the beginning of the recovery program, and if we go back to the Oxford groups, movements, and Charlie and I happen to know a guy that was in there. They sobered up in Akron, Paul Kleber, Paul's great friend of ours in St. Louis, and Paul was sobered up in the Akron group. Now, in the Akron group, when you went in, you started out on step three. How did they do that? Well, when they went out on a 12-step call, when they come to your house, they would say, come to visit you in a hospital or at home or in jail somewhere, wherever you were, they would sit down and tell you their story. They would tell you their story, which is your first step. And as you tell your story right today on a 12-step call, we do that. We should be. When we tell our story to an alcoholic, he can find himself in us and identify with us. And he takes step one by, and then we talk to him and get him to see that he's powerless over alcohol and his life was unmanageable. And then they would say, well, can we come back and visit you in a few days? And they would go back on the second visit. And then they would talk to him for a long time and see if he believed in God, see about his spiritual concepts. See where he was, if his belief was sufficient to begin. And once they were, you know, convinced that this guy believed in God, then they would say, would you like to go to a meeting with us, one of our Oxford group meetings? And he would say yes, quite naturally. And when they took him to the meeting, they would have already convinced him of steps one and two. And when they took him to a meeting, their program began at step three in those days. But you can see what the difficulty Bill was in. He was not going to be able to come to Texas and talk to the first person about steps one and two. So the first four chapters had to do that job. The first four chapters had to carry the message of steps one and two. And now, he says, we start off on the program of recovery. The first step of recovery is step three. There is no recovery in the first two steps. You know, the first step shows you where you are. The second step shows you where you need to be. And the last 10 steps shows you how to get there. You know, now this is a main job. How do we get there?
When these guys originally were convinced themselves that this fella could see his powerlessness over alcohol and the unmanageability of his life. When they themselves could believe that this fellow believed in God also, then they would take him to a meeting. And they would introduce him in the meeting, and they'd say, now, we want to sponsor this fellow into this group. That's what sponsorship used to be, just like going into the Rotary Club or the Lions Club or anything else. And the group would vote whether to accept him or not. And if they accepted him, then three or four or five of them would take him upstairs in either T. Henry Williams' house or Dr. Bob's house. They would all get down on their knees, and he would take step three, which was then step one. And then after he got through, they would all vote as to, well, how well he took it. And if they didn't think he took it right, they'd say, no, you're going to have to do this again. We need to talk to you some more, see. So it's obvious what he's done with the first part of our book. Okay. Now, if we're convinced on those vital issues, then we are now at what the book refers to as step three. Let's go to page 60. On step three, it says, being convinced we were at step three, which is we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? Well, I think the first thing we got to do is look at some words. Again, if our understanding of the words is different than the writer's, we're going to receive garbled information. And I think one of the most misunderstood words in this whole thing is this word decided, or the word decision. I don't know how many people I've heard say that I've been in AA 4 or 5 years and my life is still all screwed up and I don't know why, because I turned my will and my life over to God when I took step three, 4 or 5 years ago. No, we didn't turn it over in step three. We made a decision to turn it over in step three. If we could turn it over in step three, we would not need any other steps. All we do is make a decision. And a decision implies further action. I think a perfect example is in mine and Barbara's life. Every fall of the year, Barbara and I would decide to go to Los Angeles, California, and visit relatives. Now, the old problem with that was we never did anything about the decision. And we wouldn't get to California. And the next year, we'd make the same decision, do nothing about it, and we wouldn't get to California. About 3 years ago, we made the decision. And I took my car down, and I had it serviced. Barbara packed some clothes and a little food, and we put it in the car, and we drove from my farm to Tulsa, Oklahoma. And then from Tulsa, Oklahoma, we drove to Oklahoma City, and then to Amarillo, Texas, and then to Albuquerque, and then to Flagstaff. And you know, we ended up in Los Angeles visiting relatives because we took action based upon our decision. All we're doing in three is deciding to do this. We haven't done it. And what is it we're going to do? What are we going to turn over? Well, are we going to turn over our will? And what is our will? Well, our will is nothing more than our thinking apparatus, our thought pattern, or our mind, this thing that tells us what to do. And I think an example of that is the word we use that is called will. You know, if I'm reaching the end of my life, and I've accumulated some material things, and I begin to be concerned about what's going to happen to them, I'll usually go to an attorney, and he and I'll sit down. And he'll take my thinking as of that day and write it down on a piece of paper. I say, I want my wife to have this, my son to have this, my daughter to have this, my brother to have this, and whatever my thinking is that day, he puts it down on a piece of paper. Now, when I die, they rush me out to the cemetery, they put me in the ground as fast as they can, and they hurry back to that attorney's office. And he gets out that piece of paper, and he reads to them what my thinking was back there before I died, and we call that thing a will. And that's all will is this thinking thing up here in our head. Reads to them what my thinking was back there before I died, and we call that thing a will. And that's all will is this thinking thing up here in our head. Now, We also decide to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood it. And what is my life? Well, my life is nothing more than my actions. All the actions that I've taken throughout my entire lifetime have put me exactly where I am right now today. My life today is the sum total of everything I've ever done all my life. Actions always follow thinking. All action is born in thought. Now, if my thinking is right, then probably my actions will be right. If my actions are right, then probably my life will be right. I had a hell of a time with step three because I was scared to death of it. I went to my sponsor and I said, I don't believe I can take step three. He said, how come? And I said, I have no idea what God would want me to be. I said, God might want me to be a missionary in Africa or China or something. I don't want to do that. And he just laughed. And he said, well, Charlie, at least it wouldn't be in the hands of a damned idiot, would it? He said, let's look back in your life. He said, you've always been a selfish, self-centered, self-willed human being. You've always made your decisions. You've always thought the way you wanted to think. And he said, your actions have always followed your thinking. He said, now, your problem has been that your thinking has been kind of faulty. And he said, if your thinking is faulty, then your actions will be faulty and your life will become a living hell. He said, left upon your own resources, you don't stand a chance. But he said, if God could direct your thinking, it might become better. And he said, if your thinking becomes better, your actions will undoubtedly become better. And if your actions become better, probably your life will become better. He said, Charlie, you don't stand a chance of peace of mind, serenity, and happiness unless you let something or somebody direct your thinking for you. He said, if you don't take step three, you'll never survive. That I could understand.
I think I tell Charlie, we all approach this step with apprehension. He says we balked at every step. And as Charlie said, you know, step three is just a decision. And a decision implies further action. The only way actually we can turn our will and our life with care of God is we do this in step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. There are other steps. We just make a decision to do those, take those action steps. But I had a lot of problems, and when they talk about, you know, I just read it and I didn't read it complete. You know, I mean, we always read fast. And I said, I ain't going to turn my life over to God. That's what I read into it. And I wasn't worried about him making me a missionary. I didn't think I could qualify for a missionary. But I had one great fear. One great fear. I figured if God got my life, if I ever give it to him, I had a great fear that he was going to put me in the Salvation Army band. I could just see myself in there with that little horn, you know. Playing Rock of Ages, you know, standing on the corner at Christmas time. John, now, I think about that. I laugh about it now because we go a lot of places. I'm always very observant of the Salvation Army band. I don't know why I had that fear, but it's been many years now, and I have never seen a black guy in a Salvation Army band. That ain't our kind of music.
I heard the story not long ago of the two people in the Salvation Army band. They were taking a shower together. One looked at the other and said, you got the longest belly button I ever saw. He said, by God, you carried the flag for a while. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Now, it's plain for us to see that we're going to have to turn loose the self-will. Bill told us back at the beginning in his story, simple but not easy, a price had to be paid. It meant the destruction of self-centeredness. As long as we run on self-will, we're always going to do what we want to do. And it's always going to give us the same old problems we've always had. We're always going to be in collision with people, places, and things. And as we do things that hurt other people, then they're going to retaliate against us. And that's going to create pain and suffering for us. And there's no way we can find a life where we can be sober and peaceful and happy and free and serene if we run on self-will. Because we're always going to be suffering pain and humiliation. We're always going to suffer restless irritability and discontent, run on self-will. We've all run on it all of our life, and that was the end result that we got out of self-will. But I think before we can do anything about really getting rid of self-will, we've almost got to understand it a little bit better. And, you know, humankind has always had a great problem when it comes to self-will. We're the only animals on the face of this earth that's got it. Everything else on the face of the earth is God-directed. The birds, the fish, the beasts of the field, etc. God directs them in their lives. They do not have any choices. They don't have this thing called self-will. When it comes time for them to reproduce their race, God decides when that's going to be. When it comes time for them to move from one part of the world to the other, God decides when that's going to be. And when it comes time for directions on how to go from here to there, God gives them directions. But he also said, those that I direct, then I will provide for. And all of the other animals on the face of the earth, you don't see them out here working like we work. Hell, the cattle graze off the grass that's already there. You know, I talk about dumb animals. By God, I've got two dogs that are eating me out of house and home. And they ain't doing a lick of work. God provides for those that he directs. Now, in the beginning, he provided for us also. You've got to go back to a story that's in the big, big book. And it's a story about a couple called Adam and Eve. And Adam and Eve were in a place that was, I guess, really indescribably wonderful. They called it the Garden of Eden. Joe and I refer to it as Serenity Park. That's where they were. And God provided for them in Serenity Park everything that they needed. They didn't need any clothes because the weather was always good. They didn't have to work because God provided them with all the food that they ate. They had no problem regarding sex because there wasn't any sex involved at that particular time. And God told them, he said, you can have anything you want in this garden except for one thing. He said, you see that tree over there? And they said, yeah. And he said, that's an apple tree. And he said, you see that little red apple hanging up there? And they said, yeah. And he said, don't eat that apple. He said, if you eat that apple now, you're going to be in serious trouble. Now, they didn't know that they had self-will. You see, nobody had ever told them they did, nor had they ever exercised it. So they assumed that whatever God said, that was it. They went right along with his idea. And they lived in the park, the apple on the tree, and he didn't touch it for a long time. And one day, Eve, she was out there fooling around the bushes, don't know what she's doing, but a snake came sidling up at her. And he said, Eve, he said, you see that tree over there? And she said, yeah. He said, you see that apple on it? And she said, yeah. And he said, that apple is good to eat. He said, why don't you and Adam eat that apple? And Eve said, oh, we can't do that. And the snake said, why? And she said, because God told us not to. Probably the snake said, who in the hell do you think he is, God? He said, you know, you can eat that apple. I can't, but you can. He said, you've got self-will. And you do whatever you want to do. And if you want to eat that apple, by golly, you can eat it. And she said, I didn't know that. And he said, you sure as hell can. And after a while, Adam came stumbling along. And she told Adam what the snake had said. He said, you mean we can eat it? She said, yeah. She said, won't you pick it off that tree and let's eat it? Adam picked the apple off the tree, and they ate it. Now then, after a while, God came along. And God looked up in that tree, and that apple wasn't there. And he said to Adam, he said, Adam, where's the apple off the tree? And Adam said, well, we ate the apple. God said, you ate the apple? He said, yeah. And he said, how come? He said, I told you you could not eat that apple. Now, we are convinced that Adam was also alcoholic. Because the first thing he did was turn around and say, she made me do it. And we think maybe Eve was the first compulsive overeater the world ever knew. And as the result of that self-will, God threw him out of the park. He said, I'm through with you. Go on. Take care of yourself. He said, the only time that I'll ever take your self-will back is when you freely give it back to me. He said, you're free to exercise it all you want to, but he said, I no longer am going to support you and take care of you unless you give it back. And he said, the day you give it back, then I will begin to provide for you again, just like I do the rest of the animals on the face of the earth. But the covenant is that you can keep it as long as you want it. I'll only take it back when you give it back to me. I think you really can't knock Adam for doing this, you know. After all, this was the first exercise in self-will. He had no experience at it at all. So you really can't knock him for making that decision when he really didn't know what the results is going to be. But from then on, when they left, they knew from then on that they would be making their own decisions, and then they were responsible for them for the rest of the time. Now, the only way that you and I can give self-will back to God is to freely give it back to him. He will only take it from us when we are ready to give it back. And the only way that we're going to be able to give it back is to first remove the things that block us off from giving it back. And there are certain things within the personality of we human beings that block us off from giving this thing back to God, even though we might want to give it back to God. Joe and I one day stumbled into the 12 and 12, and we found a piece of information in step 4 in the 12 and 12, which I think probably has taught me more about human nature on about 2 or 3 pages than I'd ever learned before. There, he talked about the things that make up self-will, the basic instincts of life, which creates this thing called self-will, Joe.
I'll put it on the board. Which one you put now? Okay. He talks about it in 12 and 12. And again, it's an attempt to. He says this: if men and women didn't exert themselves to be comforted, there would be no society. And he said if we didn't harvest food to construct shelter, the human race wouldn't survive. And if it wasn't sex, the world wouldn't reproduce. And as here he begins to describe the 3 basic instincts that all human beings have, which is a pattern of instincts that make up self-will. And they're not bad, they're God-given, and they play a useful purpose in our lives. And we can talk about the social instinct. You know, if we didn't have the companionship and prestige, self-esteem, these are natural instincts that we all have. The human race wouldn't survive without them. You know, if we didn't care about one another, it's a natural desire within every person to be a part of something. And we humans do not survive unless we survive together. We're one animal that really need each other. You know, and it's a basic instinct within us that brings us together for our survival. So this is a natural thing in each and every person. Our self-esteem, our prestige, we have a desire for leadership. Some of us have that drive, and that brings us to the head of the group, to lead the group. And without leaders, the human race will not survive. All of these things are basically necessary, right, and God-given. We also have ambitions in this area We all have this desire within us, and it's natural and right and surely God-given. In the second column, we all have a security instinct. If it wasn't for security, we wouldn't harvest food or construct shelter. And if we didn't harvest food and construct shelter, the human race would not survive. The human race would have died out many years ago. So this is a basic instinct. We all, you know, this is really what creates our society. This is what makes people get up and go to work, security. I mean, we won't go to work because they want to. It's that instinct to be secure that makes us go to work. And everybody going to work produces a total economy of the total society. Now, I also have a third column, which is basic and natural in our lives. We all have an instinct, a sexual instinct. And it's a fulfillment of this instinct that brings on sex. And sex brings on the reproduction of the human race. So God placed in man certain basic instincts, which are surely right, and he said, God-given. But still yet, these same natural instincts, Bill says in 12 and 12, these same things which are basic and God-given and necessary for our survival, at certain times far exceeds their proper function. At certain times, these things get out of control. And these natural things that we need, when they get out of control, then they become destructive. So self, we're not going to get rid of self. We're not talking about getting rid of it totally. We're going to make a decision, and we're going to try to go to work on this thing to get it back where it's healthy in our life. So these things are all problems are the root of this. You know, there's not a human problem that we can come up with. Bill said it, all human problems rise out of this. And not only alcoholism, but anybody, there are many people in trouble today. And I love this chart, and once you understand it, there are a lot of different problems, the people in prisons, the people here, and the people in the void, this little kid's in trouble. Every human being today, right this afternoon, is in trouble. We could trace his trouble right back to something on this chart. It's one of these things on this chart that's out of control. We say the guy that's in prison. Maybe he's in prison for stealing. Okay, well, that's why he's in prison. Well, what is the root of his problem? What caused him to steal? Yeah. Did he steal for material security? Or did he steal for companionship? Or did he steal to get something to build his self-esteem? Or did he steal to get something to produce his sex life? There's one part of self that had to be out of control that caused him to do the thing that got him in trouble. We could trace all human problems back to a part of self. Self is the root of all human problems.
Let's look at this chart very carefully, because this chart is the key, really, to all the rest of the steps. Now, God not only gave us these basic instincts of life, but he gave them to all the rest of the animals, too. But the only difference is, with the other animals, they don't have any choices about them at all, where you and I do through this thing called self-will. All the animals on the face of the earth, they have a desire to join together. We call it the herd instinct, the flock instinct, or in case of the fish, the school instinct. All human beings are born with a basic desire to be liked and accepted and respected by other members of the human race. Because if we didn't join together with each other, we simply could not survive, because sooner or later it would be dog eat dog, the world would go into complete anarchy, and the human race would simply fade out of the picture. Now, with the rest of the animals, though, that basic instinct comes from God direction, period, and they don't have any choices about it. But you and I have the ability to choose and make decisions in that area. We can decide what we want to do and whenever we want to do it. Now, in order for you and I to be liked and accepted and respected by the rest of the human race, the first thing we're going to have to find out, well, what is it that they demand of us? And this will be different in different parts of the world. In one part of the world, it may be a high school education. Another part of the world, it may be a college education. Another part of the world, it might be a landowner. It can vary in different parts of the world. And we once decide what it is that they want from us, then we set our goal. And we set that goal, and we work toward that goal. To be liked and accepted and respected by the rest of the human race is hard work. You're going to have to work at it and work at it and work at it and work at it in order to reach the goal, whatever it is that we've set. By the same token, we're going to have to sacrifice. We're going to have to give up some of the things that we would really like to do. Because if they find out we're doing them, they're not going to like us at all. So I doubt, though, that you and I would do the work necessary nor make the sacrifices necessary to be liked and accepted and respected by other people if we did not get some kind of reward for that. God knows this also. And the reward that you and I get is that great feeling that we get at the moment of successful completion of the goal. Bill said it in his story. He said, I had arrived. He was sitting on top of the world. And you and I have done it too. We set our goal and we've worked and worked and worked and sacrificed and sacrificed, and the moment we successfully completed the goal, oh my God, that feels good. Great, great feeling. The only thing wrong with it, though, it seems to be just a temporary feeling. You no sooner reach the goal and you look around, you say, well, is this all there is to it? And we set another goal and we take off again. And we work and we work and we work and we work and we finally reach that goal and we experience the same thing, a temporary feeling of real good feelings and elation, but it doesn't last very long, and we set another goal and we take off, and it seems to create an insatiable desire for more recognition from other people, for more acceptance from other people, for more power, for more prestige, and etc., and we're not getting there fast enough, and they're not letting us have what we think they ought to let us have. And we begin to do a little lying, a little conning, a little manipulating, a little stealing, a little cheating. And when we do that, then we hurt other people. And we hurt other people, then that throws them in conflict with us. And they retaliate, and that creates pain and suffering for us. It's plain that a life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success, because under those conditions, we're always in collision with other people, places, and things. Same thing is true with the security instinct. Every human being is born with a basic desire to be secure in the future. Other animals are too. Look at the little squirrel. The little squirrel is putting nuts in that tree this fall, so he'll have something to eat next winter. I doubt, though, if he really knows why he's doing that. It's purely at God's direction. Now, I know in AA we're supposed to live one day at a time. But I also know that just about everybody in this room has got an insurance policy of some kind to protect ourselves in the future. If we didn't have the desire to be secure in the future, we wouldn't build the housing that we need to protect ourselves from the elements. We wouldn't store away the food that we need to protect ourselves during the winter time or the next drought season. And sooner or later, the human race would fail to survive. So it is a God-given instinct absolutely necessary for survival of the human race. But if you want to be secure, just like if you want to be recognized and accepted, you got to work at it. You can't sit on your duff and be secure in the future. You got to work. You got to save your money. You got to invest your money. You got to do this and this and this. And at the same time, you got to sacrifice. Now, you can't buy a new dress every day, or a new suit, or a new car, or a new this every time you turn around and blow your money and still be secure in the future. And I doubt if you and I would do the work necessary nor make the sacrifices necessary to be secure in the future if we didn't get a reward for it. And the reward that we get is that same great feeling at the moment of successful completion of the goal. How many of us have set the goal for the new house, the new car, the new suit, the new whatever it is we think we need? And we work at it, and we work at it, and we work at it, and finally we get it, and oh my God, it feels good. It really does. But the only thing wrong with it is just temporary feeling. You no sooner get it than you look around, and that sucker's driving a damn Cadillac, and me and this Chevrolet. Or she's got a mink coat, and I don't have. Or he's got this and this, or that piece of land, and I don't have. So I set myself a new goal. And I work at it, and I work at it, and I work at it, and I succeed again, and all the time my security, I'm getting more and more and more, but it seems to create an insatiable desire for more of the same. It seems as though we can never get enough to really feel secure. And we're not getting there fast enough, and we're not getting what we think we ought to have, so we begin to lie, cheat, con, manipulate, and when we do, we hurt other people. And they retaliate, and then that creates pain and suffering for us. It's plain that a life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success, because under those conditions, we're always in collision with people, places, and things. The third basic instinct is this thing called sex. Now, I know in AA we treat sex kind of as a dirty word. We talk about it a hell of a lot. Most of us don't do much about it anymore. I'm not sure we even know what we're talking about when we talk about it. But all human beings are born with a basic desire to have sex. Because without sex, there's no reproduction of the human race. And without reproduction of the human race, then sooner or later we fail to survive. So it is a basic God-given thing. Now, the only thing wrong with this sex deal is just like the other two. For successful completion of sex, for reproduction of the human race, it takes a hell of a lot of work. You know, you really got to work to successfully complete sex. Hell, you can do more work in 3 minutes of sex than you do all day digging a damn ditch. You fall over sideways when you're through with it, and the sweat's just pouring off of you, and you can hardly get your breath, and you feel like you've gone to hell and come back two or three times. And I doubt very seriously if we would do the work involved if we did not get a reward for doing the work. And the reward that we get is that great feeling that we get both physically and emotionally at the moment of successful completion of the sex act. It's one of the greatest feelings that the human race can possibly experience. But also, just like the other two, it seems to be just a temporary feeling. You no sooner get through with it than you go to thinking about doing it again. And you get to thinking about doing it in different places. And you get to thinking about doing it in different positions with different people at different times. And it seems to create an insatiable desire for more of the same. And we're not getting enough of it, or it isn't the right kind, and we want more, and we begin to do it at the wrong time and the wrong places with the wrong people. And when we do, we begin to hurt people. And then they retaliate against us, and then that creates pain and suffering for us. It's plain that a life run on self-will could hardly ever be a success, because under those conditions, we're always in collision with people, places, and things. Now, if we could all have these three things, at the level that God intended, and if all human beings in this world had them at the level that God intended, then there would be no conflict in the human race. And everything would be great. But left on self-will, since it creates the insatiable desires, we always carry them further than what God intended for us to do. And that's the root cause of all troubles in the human race today, by the overdoing in those three areas, creating problems for other people, and they retaliate back, and we have a hell of a situation. Now, there are three wrongs that emanate from self-will. And we've got to look at words again. You know, we see the word wrong or wrongs in step five, and almost immediately we think of a list of dirty, filthy, nasty things. But if we go to the dictionary and look up the word wrong, we'll find that there's many different definitions of it. And I think there's three of them in there that fit what we're talking about right here. It tells us in the dictionary that incorrect judgment of other people is considered to be a wrong. And we're going to find out a little bit later in our inventory process that that's exactly what a resentment is. It also tells us that incorrect believing is considered to be a wrong. And we're going to find out in our inventory process that that's what fear is. 99% of the cases, the fears that you and I have experienced all of our lifetime did not come true. If they had have come true, we certainly wouldn't be sitting here in this room today. Most fears are incorrect believing. We're going to find also that incorrect acting, which leads to harm for another human being, is considered to be a wrong. Now there are three common manifestations of one who is spiritually sick. You know, everybody knows about physical illness. And we know that when we're physically ill, there will be certain symptoms of that, or certain manifestations. If you have a certain disease, it's going to create a certain pain here, a pain there, a weakness here. And the doctor can read those symptoms and find out what that physical illness is. We know that if we're mentally ill, there will always be certain symptoms of that. And a trained psychiatrist can take those symptoms and determine what the illness actually is. But you've also got certain symptoms for spiritual illness too. One who is spiritually sick is one who's separated from God, running on self-will, and there will always be certain symptoms that will indicate spiritual sickness. One is a resentment, and one is a fear, and one is continual harming of other people. You show me a selfish, self-centered individual, one who is separated from God, and I'll show you one that's battered hell all the time. The world's not treating them right. Damn them, they're not doing this, and damn them, they're not doing that, and damn them, they shouldn't have done this, and damn it, I'm going to do this to them, and we're always just madder than hell. Show me a selfish, self-centered person. One who is separated from God, I'll show you one that is always filled with fear. You remember back in Little Abner, there was a guy ran around, and everywhere he went, there was a rain cloud hanging over his head. And everywhere he went, that rain was falling out of his head, and he created absolute catastrophe. Anywhere he went, his name was Joe Blitzfiger, so I'm just like him. I never knew what the hell was going to happen tomorrow, but I knew when it got here. It wasn't going to be worth a damn, whatever it was. Always run on fear. That's a symptom of spiritual illness. Show me a selfish, self-centered person. I'll show you one that's always doing things that hurt other people. That is a symptom of spiritual illness. And our book tells us we've been not only mentally ill and physically ill, but we've been spiritually sick. And it said when the spiritual malady is overcome, then the other two will straighten out. So our book is going to ask us before too long to begin to look at these manifestations, these symptoms of spiritual illness, which come from a life run on self-will. One who runs on God's will does not have those things. One who runs on self-will has those things and is considered to be spiritually ill. Now that I can see what self-will does to me, now that I can see where it comes from, now that I can see that I'll never have peace of mind, serenity, and happiness operating on my own, now that I can see under those conditions I'm always going to hurt people and be filled with resentment and fear, then I can begin to see why I need to try to give this thing back to God. But only I can make this decision. Nobody else can make it for me. And I'm not going to make it unless I absolutely know why I have to make it. And I think this little piece of information that Bill put in the 12 and 12 is one of the finest examples of human nature and why we need to take step 3, why we need to try to turn this thing back to God as we understand it. Finest thing I've ever read, Joe.
Okay, now here, I think, as Charlie says, once we understand this, we can make this decision. I guess we're going to take a break a minute. But, okay. Charlie was talking about sex. I can't wait to tell my new sex joke. He usually tells all the stories, you know. This is a new one, brand new one. And he needs something fresh. But they said this couple, this old fellow was getting way up in age, and he went to the doctor one day, and the doctor was kind of concerned. And the doctor said, man, said, I'm sure glad you come back here. He said, I got bad news for you. He said, I don't see. He said, you just ain't going to make it. He said, I don't believe you're going to live but 24 more hours. And he said, ooh, so he said, I better rush home. So he rushed home. He told his wife, he said, look, I'm not going to live but one more day. Tomorrow I'm going to die. And she said, he said, "Looks like we could, we know we're getting of age, but we could have sex one more time tonight." And so she said, "Okay." And so he got in bed that night, and she had her head turned over, and he was hit on the back. And she said, "Leave me alone." He said, "What's the matter with you?" She said, "I got a bad headache." "Headache?" And she said, "Yeah, and on top of that, I got to get up early in the morning. I got a big film to get ready for."
Our book goes ahead on the rest of page 60 and 61, talking about the actor who wants to run the whole show.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
And I think now that we can see these things that come out of self, we can see how we do want to run the whole show to satisfy ourselves. All of us, as we grew up, we wrote our own script. And we all decided what it was we wanted to be. And we proceeded to conduct our life in such a manner so that we could be that. And not only did we write our script, but we wrote a script for other people that were going to play a part in our life too. You know, I had planned in my life what my wife would be like and what she would do so we would have a successful marriage. And I had planned in my life what my children would be, what sex they would be, and the kind of kids they would be so we could have a fine family. And I set the stage, and I put the actors in place, and the show began to proceed. Yeah, the only thing wrong with it, I didn't know that my wife had written a script for her life, too. And she didn't particularly agree with what I wanted to have. So we were in immediate conflict. I didn't realize that someday my children would quit listening to me. And they had their own little show going, and they wanted to do what they wanted to do. So we were in conflict, too. I didn't realize my boss would not play the part that I wanted him to. Trying to fit them in, I was in continual conflict with people, places, and things. Trying to do what I wanted to do, not paying any attention to what they wanted to do, always trying to force my will on other people. We are like the actor that wants to run the whole show. And when the play doesn't come off right, then we just try harder and harder and harder and harder. Small wonder that we are in continual conflict and have no peace of mind. And Bill explains that to us on page 60 and 61. Then on 62, he tells us just exactly why we need to do this thing. And then on 63, he tells us why to do it. Let's look at that, and then we'll take the break. Sure.
Selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. And he says earlier, most people, we're not any different. Most people, other people try to live on self. All humans are motivated by self-will. He said, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find that sometime in the past, we have made a decision based on self, which placed us in a position to be hurt. Now, I think when we get an inventory, we're going to see that. Most time in step three, we can't realize that. But after we analyze things, we will see that this is what has happened. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of a self-will run right, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of selfishness. We must, or it kills us. How do we get rid of it? God makes that possible. So we can't get rid of self with self. I think that's one of the greatest difficulties we're making. We are trying to make ourselves better with self-will. Now, that's like putting a gasoline fire out with gasoline.
You know, God made self-will.
That's right.
And only God has the power to overcome whatever he makes. And only he has the power to overcome self-will. Yeah. Period.
There often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us have moral and philosophical convictions galore. We could not live up to them even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce ourselves to sinfulness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. This is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. I love that. All we've been doing is, while we've been playing God, God's been God.
He's been running the world, whether we knew it or not. He has been.
Like kids playing mom and daddy, you know. We've been playing. It didn't work. Now, next we decided, and this is our decision, that hereafter in the drama of life, God is going to be our director. See, got it back in.
Did you, see Bill Wilson chuckling as he wrote that in?
Put it right back in there. Okay. He is the principal, we are his agents. He is the father, we are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of a new and triumphant arch to which we passed to freedom. This idea, the idea of step three. Step three is the keystone of a new and triumphant arch to which we passed to freedom. As we began earlier, somebody on the board, he said that we're building a structure. Remember, way back. And he said, the structure, the foundation, he didn't tell us what we were, up to now, what we were building. He said, we're going to put in the foundation, which is willingness. And willingness is the foundation. You know, if you want to change, you have to first, once you take step one and see the position you're in, see the problem, then you're willing to change. And this willingness is the foundation. And once we have the willingness, later on we come to step two. And at step two, we believe we can change. After we become willing, then we believe we can change when we see other people changing. And now we come to step three. Belief is a cornerstone that we put on top of the foundation. Now he tells us we're building an arch in which we shall walk free man at last. And the arch contained the stones, and the stones were built up. And the very stone in the top of the arch that all the other stone leaned against was the keystone, the supporting stone of the gate. And now he's telling us step three is the keystone and that we are building an arch. This is what we're building. Now we know what the structure is. Later on, after step five, he's going to use this same illustration. He's going to put in two more stones, step four and five, and he's going to ask us, are they properly in place? So he's painting pictures. We have to see the pictures that Bill is painting. As he's building this little arch to which we'll walk a free man at last. And that arch, he said, is a personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism. Now, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. When we had a new employer, now he tells us what happens. Being all powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves. Now that we have switched over, God is directing our lives, our little plans and desires. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, we discovered we could face life successfully. When we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fears of today, tomorrow, the hereafter. We were reborn. We were now at step three. Many of us said to our Maker as we understood him, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties as victor over them and be witness to those I would help with thy power, with thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could lash our banner ourselves utterly to him.